said that their god was morally superior to those of the neighboring tribes, because he demanded only that sheep and cattle be slaughtered on his behalf, not children. But the temptation must have been around, because the Israelites saw fit to outlaw it in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 21. You shall not give any of your children to devote them by fire to Moloch, and so profane the name of your God. For centuries, their descendants would have to take measures against people backsliding into the custom. In the 7th century BCE, King Josiah defiled the sacrificial arena of Tophet so that no one might burn his son or his daughter as an offering to Moloch. After their return from Babylon, the practice of human sacrifice died out among Jews. But it survived as an ideal in one of its breakaway sects, which believed that God accepted the torture sacrifice of an innocent man in exchange for not visiting a worse fate on the rest of humanity. The sect is called Christianity. Human sacrifice appears in the mythology of all the major civilizations. In addition to the Hebrew and Christian Bibles, it is recounted in the Greek legend in which Agamemnon sacrifices his daughter Iphigenia in hopes of bringing a fair wind for his war fleet, and the episode in Roman history in which four slaves were buried alive to keep Hannibal at bay, in a Druid legend from Wales in which priests kill the child to stop the disappearance of building materials for a fort, and in many legends surrounding the multi-armed Hindu goddess Kali and the feathered Aztec god Quetzalcoatl. Human sacrifice was more than a riveting myth. 2 millennia ago, the Roman historian Tacitus left eyewitness accounts of the practice among Germanic tribes. Plutarch described it taking place in Carthage, where tourists today can see the charred remains of the sacrificial children. It has been documented among traditional Hawaiians, Scandinavians, Incas, and Celts. Remember Bogman? It was a veritable industry among the Aztecs in Mexico, the Khans in Southeast India, and the Ashanti, Benin, and Dahomey kingdoms in Western Africa, where victims were sacrificed by the thousands. Matthew White estimates that between the years 1440 and 1524 CE, the Aztecs sacrificed about 40 people a day, 1.2 million people in all. Human sacrifice is usually preceded by torture. The Aztecs, for example, lowered their victims into a fire, lifted them out before they died, and cut the beating hearts out of their chests, a spectacle incongruously reenacted in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom as a sacrifice to Kali in 1930s India. The Dyaks of Borneo inflicted death by 1,000 cuts, slowly bleeding the victim to death with bamboo needles and blades. To meet the demand for sacrificial victims, the Aztecs went to war to capture prisoners, and the Khans raised them for that purpose from childhood. The killing of innocents was often combined with other superstitious customs, foundation sacrifices, in which a victim was interred in the foundation of a fort, palace, or temple to mitigate the effrontery of intruding into the god's lofty realm, were performed in Wales, Germany, India, Japan, and China. Another bright idea that was independently discovered in many kingdoms, including Sumeria, Egypt, China, and Japan, was the burial sacrifice. When a king died, his retinue and harem would be buried with him. The Indian practice of sati, in which a widow would join her late husband on the funeral pyre, is yet another variation. About 200,000 women suffered these pointless deaths between the Middle Ages and 1829, when the practice was outlawed. What were these people thinking? Many institutionalized killings, however unforgivable, are at least understandable. People in power kill in order to eliminate enemies, deter troublemakers, or demonstrate their prowess. But sacrificing harmless children, going to war to capture victims, and raising a doomed caste from childhood hardly seem like cost-effective ways to stay in power. In an insightful book on the history of force, the political scientist James Payne suggests that ancient peoples put a low value on other people's lives because pain and death were so common in their own. This set a low threshold for any practice that had a chance of bringing them an advantage, even if the price was the lives of others. And if the ancients believed in gods, as most people do, then human sacrifice could easily have been seen as offering them that advantage. Their primitive world was full of dangers, suffering, and nasty surprises, including plagues, famines, and wars. It would be natural for them to ask, what kind of god would create such a world? A plausible answer was, a sadistic god, a god who liked to see people bleed and suffer. So, they might think, if these gods have a minimum daily requirement of human gore, why not be proactive about it? Better him than me. Human sacrifice was eliminated in some parts of the world by Christian proselytizers such as St. Patrick in Ireland, and in others by European colonial powers like the British in Africa and India. Charles Napier, the British Army's commander-in-chief in India, faced with local complaints about the abolition of sati, replied, "You say that it is your custom to burn widows. Very well. We also have a custom. When men burn a woman alive, we tie a rope around their necks and we hang them. Build your funeral pyre. Beside it, my carpenters will build a gallows. You may follow your custom, and then we will follow ours." In most places, though, human sacrifice died out on its own. It was abandoned by the Israelites around 600 BCE, and by the Greeks, Romans, Chinese, and Japanese a few centuries later. Something about mature, literate states eventually leads them to think the better of human sacrifice. One possibility is that the combination of a literate elite, the rudiments of historical scholarship, and contacts with neighboring societies gives people the means to figure out that the bloodthirsty god hypothesis is incorrect. They infer that throwing a virgin into a volcano does not, in fact, cure diseases, defeat enemies, or bring them good weather. Another possibility favored by Paine is that a more affluent and predictable life erodes people's fatalism and elevates their valuation of other people's lives. Both theories are plausible, but neither is easy to prove, because it's hard to find any scientific or economic advance that coincides with the abandonment of human sacrifice. The transition away from human sacrifice always has a moral coloring. The people who live through the abolition know they have made progress, and they look with disgust at the unenlightened foreigners who cling to the old ways. One episode in Japan illustrates the expansion of sympathy that must contribute to abolition. When the emperor's brother died in 2 BCE, his entourage was buried with him in a traditional funeral sacrifice. But the victims didn't die for several days, and they wept and wailed at night, upsetting the emperor and other witnesses. When the emperor's wife died 5 years later, he changed the custom so that clay images were placed in the tomb instead of live humans. As Paine notes, the emperor shortchanged the gods because spending human lives had become too dear.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, by Steven Pinker, performed by Arthur Morey. A sanguinary god that hungers for indiscriminate human scapegoats is a rather crude theory of misfortune. When people outgrow it, they are still apt to look to supernatural explanations for bad things that happen to them. The difference is that their explanations become more finely tuned to their particulars. They still feel they have been targeted by supernatural forces, but the forces are wielded by a specific individual rather than a generic god. The name for such an individual is a witch. Witchcraft is one of the most common motives for revenge among hunter-gatherer and tribal societies. In their theory of causation, there is no such thing as a natural death. Any fatality that cannot be explained by an observable cause is explained by an unobservable one, namely sorcery. It seems incredible to us that so many societies have sanctioned cold-blooded murder for screwball reasons, but certain features of human cognition, combined with certain recurring conflicts of interest, make it a bit more comprehensible. The brain has evolved to ferret out hidden powers in nature, including those that no one can see. Once you start rummaging around in the realm of the unverifiable, there is considerable room for creativity, and accusations of sorcery are often blended with self-serving motives. Tribal people, anthropologists have shown, often single out despised in-laws for allegations of witchcraft, a convenient pretext to have them executed. The accusations may also be used to cut a rival down to size, especially one who has boasted that he really does have magical powers. To claim to be holier than everyone else when competing in the local reputational sweepstakes, or to dispose of ornery, eccentric, or burdensome neighbors, especially ones who have no supporting relatives to avenge their deaths. People may also use allegations of witchcraft to recoup some of the losses from a misfortune by holding another party liable, a bit like American accident victims who trip on a crack or spill hot coffee on themselves and sue everyone in sight. And perhaps the most potent motive is to deter adversaries from plotting against them and covering their tracks. The plotters may be able to disprove any physical connection to the attack, but they can never disprove a non-physical connection. In Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather, Vito Corleone is credited with the principle, "Accidents don't happen to people who take accidents as a personal insult." In the movie version, he spells it out to the heads of the other crime families. "I'm a superstitious man, and if some unlucky accident should befall my son, if my son is struck by a bolt of lightning, I will blame some of the people here." Moralistic accusations can sometimes escalate into denunciations of those who fail to make moralistic accusations, snowballing into extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds. In the 15th century, two monks published an exposé of witches called Malleus Maleficarum, which the historian Anthony Grafton has called a strange amalgam of Monty Python and Mein Kampf. Egged on by its revelations and inspired by the injunction in Exodus, chapter 22, verse 18, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," French and German witch hunters killed between 60,000 and 100,000 accused witches, 85% of them women, during the next two centuries. The executions, usually by burning at the stake, followed an ordeal of torture in which the women confessed to such crimes as eating babies, wrecking ships, destroying crops, flying on broomsticks on the Sabbath, copulating with devils, transforming their demon lovers into cats and dogs, and making ordinary men impotent by convincing them that they had lost their penises. The psychology of witchcraft accusations can shade into other blood libels, such as the recurring rumors in medieval Europe that Jews poisoned the wells or killed Christian children during Passover to use their blood for matzah. Thousands of Jews were massacred in England, France, Germany, and the Low Countries during the Middle Ages, emptying entire regions of their Jewish populations. Witch hunts are always vulnerable to common sense. Objectively speaking, it is impossible for a woman to fly on a broomstick or to turn a man into a cat, and these facts are not too hard to demonstrate if enough people are allowed to compare notes and question popular beliefs. Throughout the Middle Ages, there were scattered clerics and politicians who pointed out the obvious, namely, that there is no such thing as a witch, and so persecuting someone for witchcraft was a moral abomination. Unfortunately, some of these skeptics ended up in the torture chambers themselves. These voices became more prominent during the Age of Reason and included influential writers such as Erasmus, Montaigne, and Hobbes. Some officials became infected with the scientific spirit and tested the witchcraft hypothesis for themselves. A Milanese judge killed his mule, accused his servant of committing the misdeed, and had him subjected to torture, whereupon the man confessed to the crime. He even refused to recant on the gallows for fear of being tortured again. Today, this experiment would not be approved by committees for the protection of human subjects and research. The judge then abolished the use of torture in his court. The writer Daniel Mannix recounts another demonstration. The Duke of Brunswick in Germany was so shocked by the methods used by inquisitors in his duchy that he asked two famous Jesuit scholars to supervise the hearings. After a careful study, the Jesuits told the Duke, "The inquisitors are doing their duty. They are arresting only people who have been implicated by the confession of other witches." "Come with me to the torture chamber," suggested the Duke. The priests followed him to where a wretched woman was being stretched on the rack. "Let me question her," suggested the Duke. "Now, woman, you are a confessed witch. I suspect these two men of being warlocks. What do you say?" "Another turn of the rack, executioners." "No, no," screamed the woman. "You are quite right. I have often seen them at the Sabbath. They can turn themselves into goats, wolves, and other animals." "What else do you know about them?" demanded the Duke. "Several witches have had children by them. One woman even had 8 children whom these men fathered. The children had heads like toads and legs like spiders." The Duke turned to the astonished Jesuits. "Shall I put you to the torture until you confess, my friends?" One of the Jesuits, Father Friedrich Spee, was so impressed that he wrote a book in 1631 that has been credited with ending witchcraft accusations in much of Germany. The persecution of witches began to subside during the 17th century, when several European states abolished it. The year 1716 was the last time a woman was hanged as a witch in England, and in 1749 was the last year a woman was burned as a witch anywhere in Europe. In most of the world, institutionalized superstitious killing, whether in human sacrifice, blood libel, or witch persecution, has succumbed to two pressures. One is intellectual, the realization that some events, even those with profound personal significance, must be attributed to impersonal physical forces and raw chance rather than the designs of other conscious beings. A great principle of moral advancement, on a par with "Love thy neighbor," and "All men are created equal," is the one on the bumper sticker, "Shit happens." The other pressure is harder to explain, but just as forceful: an increased valuation of human life and happiness. Why are we taken aback by the experiment in which a judge tortured his servant to prove that torture was immoral, harming one to help many? It is because we sympathize with other humans, even if we don't know them, by virtue of the fact that they are human, and we parlay that sympathy into bright lines that outlaw the imposition of suffering on an identifiable human being. Even if we have not eliminated the features of human nature that tempt us to blame others for our misfortunes, we have increasingly prevented that temptation from erupting in violence. An increased valuation of the well-being of other people, we shall see, was a common thread in the abandonment of other barbaric practices during the humanitarian revolution. Superstitious killing: violence against blasphemers, heretics, and apostates. Human sacrifice and witch burnings are just two examples of the harm that can result from people pursuing ends that involve figments of their imagination. Another may be seen in psychotics who kill in pursuit of a delusion, such as Charles Manson's plan to hasten an apocalyptic race war, and John Hinckley's scheme to impress Jodie Foster. But the greatest damage comes from religious beliefs that downgrade the lives of flesh and blood people, such as the faith that suffering in this world will be rewarded in the next, or that flying a plane into a skyscraper will earn the pilot 72 virgins in heaven. As we saw in Chapter 1, the belief that one may escape from an eternity in hell only by accepting Jesus as a Savior makes it a moral imperative to coerce people into accepting that belief and to silence anyone who might sow doubt about it. A broader danger of unverifiable beliefs is the temptation to defend them by violent means. People become wedded to their beliefs because the validity of those beliefs reflects on their competence, commends them as authorities, and rationalizes their mandate to lead. Challenge a person's beliefs, and you challenge his dignity, standing, and power. And when those beliefs are based on nothing but faith, they are chronically fragile. No one gets upset about the belief that rocks fall down as opposed to up, because all sane people can see it with their own eyes. Not so for the belief that babies are born with original sin, or that God exists in three persons, or that Ali was the second most divinely inspired man after Muhammad. When people organize their lives around these beliefs, and then learn of other people who seem to be doing just fine without them, or worse, who credibly rebut them, they are in danger of looking like fools. Since one cannot defend a belief based on faith by persuading skeptics it is true, the faithful are apt to react to unbelief with rage and may try to eliminate that affront to everything that makes their lives meaningful. The human toll of the persecution of heretics and non-believers in medieval and early modern Christendom beggars the imagination and belies the conventional wisdom that the 20th century was an unusually violent era. Though no one knows exactly how many people were killed in these holy slaughters, we can get a sense from numerical estimates by atrocitologists such as the political scientist R. J. Rummel in his books Death by Government and Statistics of Democide, and the historian Matthew White in his Great Big Book of Horrible Things, and his Deaths by Mass Unpleasantness website. They have tried to put numbers on the death tolls of wars and massacres, including those for which conventional statistics are unavailable. By combing the available sources, assessing their credibility with sanity checks and allowances for bias, and selecting a middle value, often the geometric mean of the lowest and the highest credible figures. I'll present Rummel's estimates for this era, which are generally lower than White's. Between 1095 and 1208, Crusader armies were mobilized to fight a just war to retake Jerusalem from Muslim Turks, earning them remission from their sins and a ticket to heaven. They massacred Jewish communities on the way, and after besieging and sacking Nicaea, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Constantinople, they slaughtered their Muslim and Jewish populations. Rummel estimates the death toll at 1 million. The world had around 400 million people at the time, about a sixth of the number in the mid-20th century. So the death toll of the Crusader massacres as a proportion of the world's population would today come out at around 6 million, equivalent to the Nazis' genocide of the Jews. In the 13th century, the Cathars of southern France embraced the Albigensian heresy, according to which there are two gods, one of good and one of evil. An infuriated papacy, in collusion with the King of France, sent waves of armies to the region, which killed around 200,000 of them. To give you a sense of the army's tactics, after capturing the city of Bram in 1210, they took 100 of the defeated soldiers, cut off their noses and upper lips, gouged out the eyes of all but one, and had him lead the others to the city of Cabaret to terrorize its citizens into surrendering. The reason you have never met a Cathar is that the Albigensian crusade exterminated them. Historians classify this episode as a clear instance of genocide. Shortly after the suppression of the Albigensian heresy, the Inquisition was set up to root out other heresies in Europe. Between the late 15th and early 18th centuries, the Spanish branch took aim at converts from Judaism and Islam who were suspected of backsliding into their old practices. One transcript from 16th century Toledo describes the Inquisition of a woman who was accused of wearing clean underwear on Saturday, a sign that she was a secret Jew. She was subjected to the rack and the water torture. I'll spare you the details. It was worse than waterboarding. Given several days to recover, and tortured again while she desperately tried to figure out what she should confess to. The Vatican today claims that the Inquisition killed only a few thousand people, but it leaves off the books the larger number of victims who were remanded to secular authorities for execution or imprisonment, often a slow death sentence, together with the victims of branch offices in the New World. Rummel estimates the death toll from the Spanish Inquisition at 350,000. After the Reformation, the Catholic Church had to deal with the vast number of people in Northern Europe who became Protestants, often involuntarily after their local prince or king had converted. The Protestants, for their part, had to deal with the breakaway sects that wanted nothing to do with either branch of Christianity, and, of course, with the Jews. One might think that Protestants, who had been persecuted so viciously for their heresies against Catholic doctrines, would take a dim view of the idea of persecuting heretics. But no. In his 65,000-word treatise, On the Jews and Their Lies, Martin Luther offered the following advice on what Christians should do with this rejected and condemned people. First, set fire to their synagogues or schools, and bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. Second, I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed. Third, I advise that all their prayer books and Talmudic writings, in which such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught, be taken from them. Fourth, I advise that their rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth on pain of loss of life and limb. Fifth, I advise that safe conduct on the highways be abolished completely for the Jews. Sixth, I advise that usury be prohibited to them, and that all cash and treasure of silver and gold be taken from them and put aside for safekeeping. Seventh, I recommend putting a flail, an axe, a hoe, a spade, a distaff, or a spindle into the hands of young, strong Jews and Jewesses, and letting them earn their bread in the sweat of their brow, as was imposed on the children of Adam. Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. For it is not fitting that they should let us accursed Goyim toil in the sweat of our faces while they, the holy people, idle away their time behind the stove, feasting and farting, and on top of all, boasting blasphemously of their lordship over the Christians by means of our sweat. Let us emulate the common sense of other nations and eject them forever from the country. At least he suffered most of them to live. The Anabaptists, forerunners of today's Amish and Mennonites, got no such mercy. They believed that people should not be baptized at birth, but should affirm their faith for themselves. So Luther declared they should be put to death. The other major founder of Protestantism, John Calvin, had a similar view about blasphemy and heresy. Some say that because the crime consists only of words, there is no cause for such severe punishment. But we muzzle dogs. Shall we leave men free to open their mouths and say what they please? God makes it plain that the false prophet is to be stoned without mercy. We are to crush beneath our heels all natural affections when his honor is at stake. The father should not spare his child, nor the husband his wife, nor the friend that friend who is dearer to him than life. Calvin put his argument into practice by ordering, among other things, that the writer Michael Servetius, who had questioned the Trinity, be burned at the stake. The third major rebel against Catholicism was Henry VIII, whose administration burned, on average, 3.25 heretics per year. With the people who brought us the Crusades and Inquisition on one side, and the people who wanted to kill rabbis, Anabaptists, and Unitarians on the other, it's not surprising that the European wars of religion between 1520 and 1648 were nasty, brutish, and long. The wars were fought, to be sure, not just over religion, but also over territorial and dynastic power. But the religious differences kept tempers at a fever pitch. According to the classification of the military historian Quincy Wright, the wars of religion embrace the French Huguenot Wars, 1562 through 94, The Dutch Wars of Independence, also known as the 80 Years' War, 1568 through 1648, the 30 Years' War, 1618 through 48, the English Civil War, 1642 through 48, the Wars of Elizabeth I in Ireland, Scotland, and Spain, 1586 through 1603, the War of the Holy League, 1508 through 16, and Charles V's wars in Mexico, Peru, France, and the Ottoman Empire, 1521 through 52. The rates of death in these wars were staggering. During the 30 Years' War, soldiers laid waste to much of present-day Germany, reducing its population by around a third. Rommel puts the death toll at 5.75 million. Which, as a proportion of the world's population at the time, was more than double the death rate of World War I, and was in the range of World War II in Europe. The historian Samuel Schama estimates that the English Civil War killed almost 500,000 people, a loss that is proportionally greater than that in World War I. It wasn't until the second half of the 17th century that Europeans finally began to lose their zeal for killing people with the wrong supernatural beliefs. The Peace of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War in 1648, confirmed the principle that each local prince could decide whether his state would be Protestant or Catholic, and that the minority denomination in each one could more or less live in peace. Pope Innocent X was not a good sport about this. He declared the peace null, void, invalid, unjust, damnable, reprobate, inane, empty of meaning and effect for all time. The Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions began to run out of steam in the 17th century, declined further in the 18th, and were shut down in 1834 and 1821, respectively. England put religious killing behind it after the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Though the divisions of Christianity have sporadically continued to skirmish right up to the present, Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland and Catholics and Orthodox Christians in the Balkans, today the disputes are more ethnic and political than theological. Beginning in the 1790s, Jews were granted legal equality in the West, first in the United States, France, and the Netherlands, and then, over the following century, in most of the rest of Europe. What made Europeans finally decide that it was all right to let their dissenting compatriots risk eternal damnation and, by their bad example, lure others to that fate? Perhaps they were exhausted by the wars of religion, but it's not clear why it took 30 years to exhaust them rather than 10 or 20. One gets a sense that people started to place a higher value on human life. Part of this newfound appreciation was an emotional change, a habit of identifying with the pains and pleasures of others. And another part was an intellectual and moral change, a shift from valuing souls to valuing lives. The doctrine of the sacredness of the soul sounds vaguely uplifting, but in fact is highly malignant. It discounts life on earth as just a temporary phase that people pass through, indeed an infinitesimal fraction of their existence. Death becomes a mere rite of passage, like puberty or a midlife crisis. The gradual replacement of lives for souls as the locus of moral value was helped along by the ascendancy of skepticism and reason. No one can deny the difference between life and death or the existence of suffering, but it takes indoctrination to hold beliefs about what becomes of an immortal soul after it is parted company from the body. The 17th century is called the Age of Reason, an age when writers began to insist that beliefs be justified by experience and logic. That undermines dogmas about souls and salvation, and it undermines the policy of forcing people to believe unbelievable things at the point of a sword or a Judas's cradle. Erasmus and other skeptical philosophers noted that human knowledge was inherently fragile. If our eyes can be fooled by a visual illusion, such as an oar that appears to be broken at the water's surface, or a cylindrical tower in the distance that appears to be square, why should we trust our beliefs about more vaporous objects? Calvin's burning of Michael Servetius in 1553 prompted a widespread scrutiny of the very idea of religious persecution. The French scholar Sébastien Castello led the charge by calling attention to the absurdity of different peoples being unshakably certain of the truth of their mutually incompatible beliefs. He also noted the horrific moral consequences of acting on these beliefs. Calvin says that he is certain, and other sects say that they are. Calvin says that they are wrong and wishes to judge them, and so do they. Who shall be judge? Who made Calvin the arbiter of all the sects that he alone should kill? He has the word of God, and so have they. If the matter is certain, to whom is it so? To Calvin? But then why does he write so many books about manifest truth? In view of the uncertainty, we must define the heretic simply as one with whom we disagree. And if, then, we are going to kill heretics, the logical outcome will be a war of extermination, since each is sure of himself. Calvin would have to invade France and all other nations, wipe out cities, put all the inhabitants to the sword, sparing neither sex nor age, not even babies and the beasts. The arguments were picked up in the 17th century by, among others, Baruch Spinoza, John Milton, who wrote, "Let truth and falsehood grapple, truth is strong," Isaac Newton, and John Locke. The emergence of modern science proved that deeply held beliefs could be entirely false, and that the world worked by physical laws rather than by divine whims. The Catholic Church did itself no favor by threatening Galileo with torture and committing him to a life sentence of house arrest for espousing what turned out to be correct beliefs about the physical world. And the skeptical mindset, sometimes spiced with humor and common sense, was increasingly allowed to challenge superstition. In Henry IV, Part 1, Glendower boasts, "I can call spirits from the vasty deep." Hotspur replies, "Why, so can I, or so can any man. But will they come when you do call for them?" Francis Bacon, often credited with the principle that beliefs must be grounded in observation, wrote of a man who was taken to a house of worship and shown a painting of sailors who had escaped shipwreck by paying their holy vows. The man was asked whether this didn't prove the power of the gods. "Aye," he answered, "but where are they painted that were drowned after their vows?" Cruel and unusual punishments. The debunking of superstition and dogma removes one of the pretexts for torture, but leaves it available as a punishment for secular crimes and misdemeanors. People in ancient, medieval, and early modern times thought cruel punishments were perfectly reasonable. The whole point of punishing someone is to make him so unhappy that he and others won't be tempted to engage in the prohibited activity. By that reasoning, the harsher the punishment is, the better it accomplishes what it is designed to do. Also, a state without an effective police and judiciary had to make a little punishment go a long way. It had to make the punishments so memorably brutal that anyone who witnessed them would be terrorized into submission and would spread the word to terrorize others. But the practical function of cruel punishments was just a part of their appeal. Spectators enjoyed cruelty, even when it served no judicial purpose. Torturing animals, for example, was good, clean fun. In 16th century Paris, a popular form of entertainment was cat burning, in which a cat was hoisted in a sling on a stage and slowly lowered into a fire. According to the historian Norman Davies, the spectators, including kings and queens, shrieked with laughter as the animals, howling with pain, were singed, roasted, and finally carbonized. Also popular were dog fights, bull runs, cock fights, public execution of criminal animals, and bear baiting, in which a bear would be chained to a post and dogs would tear it apart or be killed in the effort. Even when they were not actively enjoying torture, people showed a chilling insouciance to it. Samuel Pepys, presumably one of the most refined men of his day, made the following entry in his diary for October 13, 1660. out to Charing Cross to see Major General Harrison hanged, drawn, and quartered, which was done there, he looking as cheerful as any man could do in that condition. He was presently cut down, and his head and heart shown to the people, at which there was great shouts of joy. From thence to my lord's, and took Captain Cuttance and Mr. Shepley to the Sun Tavern, and did give them some oysters. Pepys's cold joke about Harrison's looking as cheerful as any man could do in that condition, referred to his being partly strangled, disemboweled, castrated, and shown his organs being burned before being decapitated. Even the less flamboyant penalties that we remember with the euphemism corporal punishment were forms of hideous torture. Today, many historical tourist traps have stocks and pillories in which children can pose for pictures. Here is a description of an actual pillorying of two men in 18th-century England. One of them, being of short stature, could not reach the hole made for the admission of the head. The officers of justice nevertheless forced his head through the hole, and the poor wretch hung rather than stood. He soon grew black in the face, and blood issued from his nostrils, his eyes, and his ears. The mob nevertheless attacked him with great fury. The officers opened the pillory, and the poor wretch fell down dead on the stand of the instrument. The other man was so maimed and hurt by what was thrown at him that he lay there without hope of recovery. Another kind of corporal punishment was flogging, the common penalty for insolence or dawdling by British sailors and African-American slaves. Whips were engineered in countless models that could flay skin, pulverize flesh into mincemeat, or slice through muscle to the bone. Charles Napier recounted that in the late 18th century British armed forces, sentences of 1,000 lashes were not uncommon. I have often seen victims brought out of the hospital 3 or 4 times to receive the remainder of the punishment, too severe to be borne without danger of death at one flogging. It was terrible to see the new, tender skin of the scarcely healed back laid bare again to receive the lash. I have seen hundreds of men flogged, and have always observed that when the skin is thoroughly cut up or flayed off, the great pain subsides. Men are frequently convulsed and screaming during the time they receive from 1 lash to 300, and then they bear the remainder, even to 800 or 1,000, without a groan. They will often lie as without life, and the drummers appear to be flogging a lump of dead, raw flesh. The word keelhaul is sometimes used to refer to a verbal reprimanding. Its literal sense comes from another punishment in the British Navy. A sailor was tied to a rope and pulled around the bottom of the ship's hull. If he didn't drown, he would be slashed to ribbons by the encrusted barnacles. By the end of the 16th century in England and the Netherlands, imprisonment began to replace torture and mutilation as the penalty for minor crimes. It was not much of an improvement. Prisoners had to pay for food, clothing, and straw, and if they or their families couldn't pay, they did without. Sometimes they had to pay for easement of irons, namely being released from spiked iron collars or from bars that pinned their legs to the floor. Vermin, heat and cold, human waste and scanty and putrid food not only added to the misery, but fostered diseases that made prisons de facto death camps. Many prisons were workhouses in which underfed prisoners were forced to rasp wood, break rocks, or climb moving treadwheels for most of their waking hours. The 18th century marked a turning point in the use of institutionalized cruelty in the West. In England, reformers and committees criticized the cruelty, barbarity, and extortion they found in the country's prisons. Graphic reports of torture executions began to sear the public's conscience. According to a description of the execution of Catherine Hayes in 1726, as soon as the flames reached her, she tried to push away the faggots with her hands, but scattered them. The executioner got hold of the rope around her neck and tried to strangle her, but the fire reached his hand and burned it, so he had to let it go. More faggots were immediately thrown on the fire, and in 3 or 4 hours she was reduced to ashes. The bland phrase, broken on the wheel, cannot come close to capturing the horror of that form of punishment. According to one chronicler, the victim was transformed into a huge screaming puppet, writhing in rivulets of blood, a puppet with four tentacles, like a sea monster of raw, slimy, and shapeless flesh mixed up with splinters of smashed bones. In 1762, a 64-year-old French Protestant named Jean Calas was accused of killing his son to prevent him from converting to Catholicism. In fact, he had tried to conceal the son's suicide. During an interrogation that attempted to draw out the names of his accomplices, he was subjected to the strapado and water torture, then was broken on the wheel. After being left in agony for 2 hours, Calas was finally strangled in an act of mercy. Witnesses who heard his protestations of innocence as his bones were being broken were moved by the terrible spectacle. Each blow of the iron club sounded in the bottom of their souls, and torrents of tears were unleashed too late from all the eyes present. Voltaire took up the cause, noting the irony that foreigners judged France by its fine literature and beautiful actresses without realizing that it was a cruel nation that followed atrocious old customs. Other prominent writers also began to inveigh against sadistic punishments. Some, like Voltaire, used the language of shaming, calling the practices barbaric, savage, cruel, primitive, cannibalistic, and atrocious. Others, like Montesquieu, pointed out the hypocrisy of Christians bemoaning their cruel treatment at the hands of Romans, Japanese, and Muslims, yet inflicting the same cruelty themselves. Still others, like the American physician and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, appealed to the common humanity of readers and the people who were targets of punishment. In 1787, he noted that the men, or perhaps the women, whose persons we detest possess souls and bodies composed of the same materials as those of our friends and relations. They are bone of their bone. And he added, if we consider their misery without emotion or sympathy, then the principle of sympathy will cease to act altogether and will soon lose its place in the human breast. The goal of the judicial system should be to rehabilitate wrongdoers rather than harming them. And the reformation of a criminal can never be affected by a public punishment. The English lawyer William Eden also noted the brutalizing effect of cruel punishments, writing in 1771, "We leave each other to rot like scarecrows in the hedges, and our gibbets are crowded with human carcasses." May it not be doubted whether a forced familiarity with such objects can have any other effect than to blunt the sentiments and destroy the benevolent prejudices of the people? Most influential of all was the Milanese economist and social scientist Cesare Beccaria, whose 1764 bestseller, On Crimes and Punishments, influenced every major political thinker in the literate world, including Voltaire, Denis Diderot, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. Beccaria began from first principles, namely that the goal of a system of justice is to attain the greatest happiness of the greatest number, a phrase later adopted by Jeremy Bentham as the motto of utilitarianism. The only legitimate use of punishment, then, is to deter people from inflicting greater harm on others than the harm inflicted on them. It follows that a punishment should be proportional to the harm of the crime, not to balance some mysterious cosmic scale of justice, but to set up the right incentive structure. If an equal punishment be ordained for two crimes that injure society in different degrees, there is nothing to deter men from committing the greater as often as it is attended with greater advantage. A clear-headed view of criminal justice also entails that the certainty and promptness of a punishment are more important than its severity, that criminal trials should be public and based on evidence, and that the death penalty is unnecessary as a deterrent and not among the powers that should be granted to a state. Beccaria's essay didn't impress everyone. It was placed on the papal index of forbidden books and vigorously contested by the legal and religious scholar Pierre-François Mouillard de Vouglans. Muyar mocked Beccaria's bleeding heart sensibility, accused him of recklessly undermining a time-tested system, and argued that strong punishments were needed to counteract man's innate depravity, beginning with his original sin. But Beccaria's ideas carried the day, and within a few decades, punitive torture was abolished in every major Western country, including the newly independent United States, in its famous prohibition of cruel and unusual punishments in the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. It is impossible to plot the decline of torture precisely, because many countries outlaw different uses at different times. But in comparing 15 major European countries and the United States, it is clear that the 18th century saw the greatest change because of the many humanitarian reforms that were launched in this remarkable slice of history. Another was the prevention of cruelty to animals. In 1789, Jeremy Bentham articulated the rationale for animal rights in a passage that continues to be the watchword of animal protection movements today. The question is not, can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer? Beginning in 1800, the first laws against bear baiting were introduced into Parliament. In 1822, it passed the Ill Treatment of Cattle Act, and in 1835 extended its protections to bulls, bears, dogs, and cats. Like many humanitarian movements that originated in the Enlightenment, opposition to animal cruelty found a second wind during the rights revolutions of the second half of the 20th century, culminating in the banning of the last legal blood sport in Britain, the fox hunt, in 2005. Capital punishment. When England introduced drop hanging in 1783 and France introduced the guillotine in 1792, it was a moral advance, because an execution that instantly renders the victim unconscious is more humane than one that is designed to prolong his suffering. But execution is still a form of extreme violence, especially when it is applied as frivolously as most states did for most of human history. In biblical, medieval, and early modern times, scores of trivial affronts and infractions were punishable by death, including sodomy, gossiping, stealing cabbages, picking up sticks on the Sabbath, talking back to parents, and criticizing the royal garden. During the last years of the reign of Henry VIII, there were more than 10 executions in London every week. By 1822, England had 222 capital offenses on the books, including poaching, counterfeiting, robbing a rabbit warren, and cutting down a tree. And with an average trial length at the time of 8.5 minutes, it is certain that many of the people sent to the gallows were innocent. Rummel estimates that between the time of Jesus and the 20th century, 19 million people were executed for trivial offenses. But as the 18th century came to a close, capital punishment itself was on death row. Public hangings, which had long been rowdy carnivals, were abolished in England in 1783. The display of corpses on gibbets was abolished in 1834, and by 1861, England's 222 capital offenses had been reduced to 4. During the 19th century, many European countries stopped executing people for any crime but murder and high treason, and eventually almost every Western nation abolished capital punishment outright. To get ahead in the story, of the 53 extant European countries today, all but Russia and Belarus have abolished the death penalty for ordinary crimes. A handful keep it on the books for high treason and grave military offenses. The abolition of capital punishment snowballed after World War II, but the practice had fallen out of favor well before that time. The Netherlands, for example, officially abolished capital punishment in 1982, but hadn't actually executed anyone since 1860. On average, 50 years elapsed between the last execution in a country and the year that it formally abolished capital punishment. Today, capital punishment is widely seen as a human rights violation. In 2007, the UN General Assembly voted 105-54, with 29 abstentions, to declare a non-binding moratorium on the death penalty, a measure that had failed in 1994 and 1999. One of the countries that opposed the resolution was the United States. As with most forms of violence, the United States is an outlier among Western democracies. Or perhaps I should say are outliers, since 17 states, mostly in the North, have abolished the death penalty as well. Four of them within the past 2 years. And an 18th has not carried out an execution in 45 years. But even the American death penalty, for all its notoriety, is more symbolic than real. The rate of executions in the United States as a proportion of its population has plummeted since colonial times, and that the steepest drop was in the 17th and 18th centuries, when so many other forms of institutional violence were being scaled back in the West. The very slight increase in the last 2 decades reflects the tough-on-crime policies that were a reaction to the homicide boom of the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. But in present-day America, a death sentence is a bit of a fiction, because mandatory legal reviews delay most executions indefinitely, and only a few tenths of a percentage point of the nation's murderers are ever put to death. And the most recent trend points downward. The peak year for executions was 1999, and since then, the number of executions per year has been almost halved. At the same time that the rate of capital punishment went down, so did the number of capital crimes. In earlier centuries, people could be executed for theft, sodomy, buggery, bestiality, adultery, witchcraft, arson, concealing birth, burglary, slave revolt, counterfeiting, and horse theft. In recent decades, the only crime other than murder that has led to an execution is conspiracy to commit murder. In 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty may not be applied to any crime against an individual where the victim's life was not taken, though the death penalty is still available for a few crimes against the state, such as espionage, treason, and terrorism. The means of execution has changed as well. Not only has the country long abandoned torture executions such as burning at the stake, but it has experimented with a succession of humane methods, the problem being that the more effectively a method guarantees instant death, say a few bullets to the brain, the more gruesome it will appear to onlookers who don't want to be reminded that violence has been applied to kill a living body. Hence, the physicality of ropes and bullets gave way to the invisible agents of gas and electricity, which have been replaced by the quasi-medical procedure of lethal injection under general anesthesia, and even that method has been criticized for being too stressful to the dying prisoner. As Payne has noted, in reform after reform, lawmakers have moderated the death penalty so that it is now but a vestige of its former self. It is not terrifying. It is not swift, and in its present restricted use, it is not certain. Only about 1 murder in 200 leads to an execution. What does it mean, then, to say that the United States has the death penalty? If the United States had the death penalty in robust, traditional form, we would be executing approximately 10,000 prisoners a year, including scores of perfectly innocent people. The victims would be killed in torture deaths, and these events would be shown on nationwide television to be viewed by all citizens, including children. At 27 executions a day, this would leave little time for any other television fare. That defenders of capital punishment would be appalled by this prospect shows that even they have felt the leavening effects of the increasing respect for human life. One can imagine that in the 18th century, the idea of abolishing capital punishment would have seemed reckless. Undeterred by the fear of a grisly execution, one might have thought, people would not hesitate to murder for profit or revenge. Yet today we know that abolition, far from reversing the centuries-long decline of homicide, proceeded in tandem with it, and that the countries of modern Western Europe, none of which execute people, have the lowest homicide rates in the world. It is one of many cases in which institutionalized violence was once seen as indispensable to the functioning of a society, Yet once it was abolished, the society managed to get along perfectly well without it. Slavery. For most of the history of civilization, the practice of slavery was the rule rather than the exception. It was upheld in the Hebrew and Christian Bibles and was justified by Plato and Aristotle as a natural institution that